Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, a contributor to the Bulwark, and counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. My normal partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, is traveling, so I'm on my own today, but I'm joined by a very special guest, Edward Luce, who is the Financial Times Washington correspondent and commentator, and who has just written a book out this week, Zbig, The Life of Zbigniew Brzezinski, America's Great Power Prophet. I commend it to our listeners and viewers. It is a compulsively readable biography of Zbigniew Brzezinski, I think a somewhat neglected American statesman. And we have Ed Luce here to talk about it. Welcome to Shield of the Republic.
It's a real pleasure, Eric. Thanks for having me on.
So let me start with this. There are any number of biographies of Henry Kissinger that have been published since Henry served his eight-year term in government, first as National Security Advisor, then briefly as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, and then Secretary of State during the last couple of years of the Ford administration. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor for all jam-packed 4 years of the Carter administration, has much less in the way of a kind of shelf of biographies. There's a book by my former French colleague, Justin Weiss, which is more really of an intellectual biography of Zbig's ideas. There's a collection of essays that Charles Gatti edited about various aspects of Brzezinski's career, both in and out of government. But yours is the first book, I think, that, first of all, draws heavily on Zbig's own papers and on his diary, which goes through his whole life, both public and private. Why do you think it is that Zbig has attracted so much less attention than Henry did?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on, Eric. And I should mention that in writing this biography, the Miller Center was indispensable in terms of all the memoirs, recollections of testimonies of people in the Carter administration and the LBJ one, etc. Kissinger's hard to compete with, right? He's the biggest celebrity diplomat, grand strategist in history, arguably. I think probably, definitely, certainly in modern history. He was very cooperative with biographers, at least in doing biographies, maybe not by the time they were finished. I know Walter Isaacson, who wrote a very, very good biography of Kissinger, it wasn't sent a bouquet of flowers on publication day by Henry Kissinger. But he nevertheless did cooperate with a lot of biographers. And was very good, I think, you know, throughout his career, particularly when he was in office, at engaging with the media and keeping what we like to now call his brand, that flame alive at all times. He was very seductive, and I know you know this better than I, Eric, but he did cooperate also with this biography. I had several interviews with him. He was very generous with his time and his insights. And he pointed out to me that, you know, Brzezinski only wrote, I don't know, whatever, 500-page memoir, whereas Kissinger's memoirs, his own multi-volume memoirs, extended to 4,000 pages. And he made the joke, repeated the joke he'd made before, that if you subtracted the word I or the first person singular, it was about 1,000 pages less, you know. And I think that's also part of the part itself contains a sort of clue as to why Kissinger was more of a celebrity. He was very seductive. Self-deprecating humor is a very powerful tool. And Brzezinski really didn't have that. And then the second, I think, difference is that those diaries that the family unrestricted made available to me, and the ones he kept as Carter's national security advisor, and ones throughout his life, were not made available to anybody until, except in small excerpts, to anybody until I was given them in full without conditions attached. And so he didn't really cooperate with biographers during his life. And a lot of people did ask for that cooperation. And therefore, this landed in my lap. And the moment I started reading, I was compelled. And as you know, Eric, you know, the more your ignorance retreats on a subject, the more appetite you get to learn. And that was the case with this.
My sense is that, I mean, Zbigniew, I knew him less well than I knew Kissinger, but his personality was clearly a less emollient personality than Kissinger, who was, as you say, very adept at appealing to what he read as people's priors when he spoke with them. Brzezinski, and certainly in the book, he emerges as someone who was much more argumentative, sometimes really almost for its own sake, in a funny way, more anxious to prove that he was the smartest person in the room in a visible way than Henry was, which I think sometimes worked to his detriment. But be that as it may, I think you make a very powerful case that Brzezinski was actually both in the long run, maybe a more consequential figure than Henry in terms of the lasting impact of the policies that he shaped. And also, I would say, a better national security advisor than Carter was a president. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on either or both of those questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the long term, I do think Brzezinski will look better as time goes on. Whether that's at Kissinger's expense is a different question, because Kissinger had 8 years and Brzezinski only had 4. But I think his influence as a Sovietologist, first from Harvard in the 50s and then Columbia, where he pioneered the study of comparative communism, which I think was a very, very important intellectual tool in the eventual unraveling of the Soviet Union. And his notion that actually the Soviet Union wasn't a permanent feature of the landscape, which I think Kissinger treated the Soviet Union as being. And you can sort of feel the Congress of Vienna influence there in Kissinger's approach to detente with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, that what we need is stability between great powers that are going to be around. And Brzezinski didn't share that view at all. And I think partly that was because he was originally from Poland and, you know, carried with him that fairly common and understandable sense of Polish sort of injured pride and amputated history, and therefore looked at it from a small power or relatively small power nation point of view, and saw the Soviet system as having an Achilles heel, both within the Soviet Union of its suppressed nations, the Ukrainians, the Georgians, the Tajiks, etc., but also, of course, within the Warsaw Pact countries after the Second World War, including Poland. And I think that made him, that gave him a potency in terms of expecting the Soviet Union to decline. I mean, he saw it as a gerontocratic system as well, and had this phrase actually that's attributed to him. It wasn't his own. The Soviet system selected its leaders through a process of reverse natural selection. They chose the least imaginative, the least creative, the least innovative people, and therefore it was going to collapse of its own stagnation. And I think that was right. And I think on that Kissinger was wrong. And therefore, I think history will treat Brzezinski more kindly than you know, his sometimes very combative, contentious personal behavior would let him deserve. But because over the long term, we forget those things and we look at the impact.
What about the relationship between Brzezinski and Carter, you know, as a national security advisor and as president? I mean, my sense of it from reading your book is that Brzezinski, I mean, although there were a lot of sort of backbiting in the Carter administration, and you document all of that, particularly between the State Department and NSC, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense of it is that not just because you're, you know, writing through Brzezinski's eyes because of the diaries, but the State Department, and I joined the State Department in, at the very end of this period. I was sworn in on January 2nd, 1980. So I was there for the last year that you write about in the Carter administration. And I can certainly say that this is not wrong. I mean, the State Department just seemed, you know, very, very underwhelming in terms of its analysis of what was going on in the world and its recommendations to the president for what he might do about it. And Carter certainly got frustrated, as you document. But my sense is, you know, Zbigniew ran a, you know, a pretty good process, as best one can tell, that served the president well. But Carter always wasn't necessarily up to making the decisions or resolving disputes in a way that served his longer term objectives and goals.
It's funny. It's a really intriguing question because so much of this is about personality as well. But the Carter had to be told by Brzezinski to stop saying that I am an eager student of Zbigniew. And he once said to him, look, the Americans don't want a student as their president. They want a leader.
They don't want on-the-job training.
They don't want on-the-job training. And the role of a national security advisor, as you well know, is sort of dual role. One is to be an advisor, which Brzezinski was a very strong-headed, very incisive version of. And the other is to be a broker. Now, I think is brokering between different departments and, you know, synthesizing what the whole of the administration thought and then giving that to Carter. I think he did it better than State Department thought he did it. I think they thought he was just rigging the system the whole time. I think he was probably fairer than they thought. But it is fair to say that temperamentally and in his personality, he wasn't, you know, the natural honest broker in the way that Brent Scowcroft, somebody like that, or Tom Donilon, somebody like that would clearly be. But Carter got more and more fed up during his administration with the lack of innovative ideas coming out, or the lack of ideas coming out of the State Department, and felt that that's where ideas were killed rather than originated. Whereas Brzezinski would produce ideas at the rate of knots, some of them madcap, to be fair, but some of them strategically quite brilliant. And he played he had propinquity to the Oval Office. Cy Vance did not. And he used that location for sure. He used that location to his advantage. And, you know, he sought for Carter first every day, often last. And Vance was, you know, a mile and a half away, did not see him nearly as much.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, you know, there's kind of a through line of American, you know, foreign policy going back, you know, a long way, that those, you know, immediately around the president have the president's ear and therefore have, you know, outsized influence, whether it's Clark Clifford with Harry Truman or, you know, people close to Eisenhower in the White House, like Andy Goodpaster or, you know, McGeorge Bundy, Walt Rostow. I mean, it could go on and on. I mean, this is like, and certainly Henry is like the, you know, ne plus ultra of all that. Well, before we go to Henry and Zbigniew, because I think that's a fascinating kind of relationship, set of relationships. I wanted to just poke on one thing that you said about Brzezinski having a sense that because of his Polish background, that small states mattered more in the grand scheme of things than Henry did, who may have been more focused on great power competition. This was a rap against Zbigniew, that he was at heart a Polish nationalist, and he was never able to put that down and completely, become a true American statesman, which I think is a little unfair. There's no question that that kind of Polish side of him was there and it influenced him the whole time. But, in the long run, I think he was more right than wrong. And it's not just the Polishness, right? Because in the the Grand Chessboard, you'll correct me if I got that wrong, but I think it's in the Grand Chessboard where he says, Russia without Ukraine is not an empire. And that, I think, was an important, sort of perception to have at that point in the Cold War. And it inclined him, despite all the Polish-Ukrainian, tensions that have existed historically, to be very bullish about the importance of an independent Ukraine, which I think gives the lie to the, he was really just a Polish nationalist, which a lot of his State Department critics, Cy Vance and others, used as a pretty brutal club to beat him with in backgrounding to the press.
They did. I mean, the Anglo elites, for want of a better term, the WASP elites, who had really dominated and done a pretty good job until Vietnam, a pretty brilliant job, of running American foreign policy, Dean Acheson, John McCloy, Avril Harriman, Robert Lovett, Chip Bowen to some degree. These were, with the exception of Bowen, who was of German origin, these were generally British Americans. And I say that, or English Americans. They weren't called that because, I guess, the original identity of America, but the links between them and Britain, thankfully, for my own country's history, were very strong. So another way, you could call them English Americans, the Georgetown set, the wise men. But they saw themselves as having no hyphenation, no prefix to their Americanness, whereas Brzezinski automatically was sort of suspect because of his Polishness. And I think Robert Lovett, at one point said, he'll get us into a war with Russia. And so he did have to sort of battle that those presumptions about him. I think Kissinger probably preempted some of those by downplaying his Jewish origins. I mean, he sort of went out of his way to say, oh, I'm not one of those Jewish Americans who's obsessed with Israel. I remember him saying that to me in a couple of interviews.
Yeah, and he to the point where he would sit in conversations with Nixon, where Nixon would unburden himself of, pretty vile anti-Semitic comments, with Kissinger sitting there silent, saying nothing.
It's saying nothing. And so they both handle it in a different way. Brzezinski very combatively. I mean, he went straight for the jugular when people said this to him. He wrote one quite sort of vituperative letter to Avril Harriman, saying he'd heard that he'd been accused of Polish bias, and he didn't accuse Harriman of bias against the Soviet, in his dealings with the Soviet Union, just because he was a millionaire capitalist. Why should Brzezinski be called biased? So that was a sort of typical response. But I do think it was, I think I characterize it in the book, his Polish antecedents, the fact that he'd come from that brief sort of interbellum period when Poland had a republic, was a motivating sort of boosting force for his life, even if he then became more and more American as time went on. He never lost his Polish accent, like Kissinger never lost his German accent. It's a very, very important part of his biography.
Absolutely. And I mean, I must say, I only learned from your book, I knew that he had a relationship with Pope John Paul II. I didn't realize how extensive it was, and that they wrote one another in Polish. Which is fascinating. And I also, you, I think, do a marvelous job of acquitting Zbigniew of charges of anti-Semitism. People can have different views about his judgments about the Middle East and Israel, where I think he was on much shakier ground, in my view, than he was in other areas of the world, because he knew that region less well. But I was fascinated to read about his relationship with Menachem Begin, who was Polish and by origin, and that the two of them actually developed a kind of pretty strong bond, even in the face of Carter's, visceral dislike of Begin and criticism of Begin. You get the sense that Zbig still had a healthy respect for Begin as a politician and a political figure, in part based on their common Polishness in a way.
You're absolutely right that Brzezinski's knowledge of the Middle East was pretty thin. And I suspect, he was, he wanted to help Carter solve at Camp David and before and after help Carter solve the sort of Palestinian issue for Cold War reasons. Not because he was particularly thoughtful about Israeli security and ditto for Egypt's normalization of relations with Israel. And he was also critical of Israel in ways that were sort of fairly ill-tempered and undiplomatic. And the fact that he had a Polish accent and that Poland has a long and, I'm afraid, rather dark history of anti-Semitism, made it pretty obvious that he would be the fall guy for pro-Israeli American groups' criticisms of the Carter administration. And he got a lot of brickbats. And Begin, having just been elected on his first trip to see Carter to the US in July 1977, invites photographers to watch him hand over to Brzezinski documents showing that Brzezinski's father, Tadeusz Brzezinski, a Polish diplomat, had, when based in Leipzig during the early Nazi years, given a lot of laissez-passes and passports to Jews of Polish origin in his area of Germany, and was reprimanded by the Nazi regime and then recalled eventually to Poland, which was also unhappy with this. So that was, he threw him a real solid. Mm-hmm. That was a sort of ubermensch thing for Begin to do. And so, I don't think Brzezinski was anti-Semitic. I really didn't find any evidence for that. He wasn't anti-Zionist. But as I say, his pro-Zionism might have been instrumental.
Yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
When you need to do more with less, Upwork helps you hire fast without the overhead. Find expert freelancers in design, marketing, IT, AI, and more. Never tried Upwork? Now's the perfect time. Spend your first $1,000 and get $200 in credit for your next project. No upfront costs. No long-term commitments. Just $200 to reinvest in what matters. Go to Upwork.com/save to get started. That's Upwork.com/save. Upwork.com/save.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
So let's turn to the fascinating relationship between Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, which my view of it, I will confess, has been revolutionized by reading your book. I mean, the standard kind of narrative is, two European refugees in America come to Harvard University. They're both, kind of prodigies. One of them gets tenure and one of them doesn't. And that sets them on this, course of rivalry that, manifests itself in kind of ill-tempered criticisms one of the other for the rest of their, lives. Actually, you paint a much more complex picture in which Henry actually supports Zbigniew's tenure candidacy, and that they remain on relatively good terms. It's actually, Zbigniew actually is offered to go back to Harvard three times with tenure and never takes it up. And that they maintain not only a correspondence, but a relatively cordial relationship through both their terms in office over the 12 years that they're constantly, commenting one to the other, lunching periodically. But there's also clearly, how to put it, it's I don't want to say bad blood, but there's clearly sort of waspish criticism that goes on one of the other, and some of it quite duplicitous, at least in Henry's case. I mean, one gets the sense that Zbigniew, if he had something critical to say, would say it to Henry's face, or put it in writing where Henry could see it, and maybe disagree with it, as he did from time to time, or complain about it. But Henry had and maybe this is just the personality difference between the two, Henry had the sort of tradition of saying one thing to Zbigniew's face and then saying something else to others, but in ways that would get back to Zbigniew. So I'd be interested in your sense of their personal relationship, but also going back to something else we touched on. You talked about brand and, Kissinger's concern about his brand. There is something very interesting about sort of the management of reputation and a part of senior officials in Washington. And this is in some ways, I don't say a cautionary tale, but this is a very illuminating story about how different personality types go about, managing their reputation in Washington.
It's quite funny. I mean, one of the delights of doing a biography is you get more and more into the intrigue. You begin with this is a fascinating macro story to address, and then of course you get into the byways of how humans behave. And the Kissinger Brzezinski relationship is absolutely cinematic. It's gripping. Just a minor brush of history, not of personality in 1938, because they crossed the Atlantic at the same time. Kissinger's family, nuclear family, a few weeks before the Munich, the infamous Munich Neville Chamberlain Hitler meeting, and Brzezinski's family a few weeks afterwards. They both see, the Statue of Liberty for the first time at around about the same time. Kissinger age 15, Brzezinski age 10. And they last meet at a Nobel Prize awards ceremony, not Peace Prize, for Brzezinski, a sort of lifetime achievement award in December 2016. So, I mean, the word cinematic is misused, overused. I don't think it is in the case of this extraordinary frenemyship, rivalry, friendship, having dinner at this French restaurant that no longer exists near the White House called Sans Souci, even when they were trying to cut each other's sort of professional throats, proverbially speaking. And Kissinger was a little bit duplicitous when Brzezinski was in office and he was out. I think that was his neediest phase in his life, because he'd been at the peak. And then this guy 5 years younger, who had always been sort of biting at his heels, is suddenly the main guy. And this is the fascinating thing about, you know, researching stuff. I'll have from Brzezinski's private diary an account of the conversation he had with Henry that day over lunch. And then I'll find a memorandum of conversation that Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador in Washington, had sent back to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Moscow of a dinner he had with Henry Kissinger the same night, in which Kissinger is saying quite the opposite to what Brzezinski recorded him as having said that lunch. And that, when I came across these little moments, I did find them tremendously, tremendously sort of important to include, or at least to sort of reference some of this. Because I think your characterization is correct. Kissinger was more wily than Brzezinski. Brzezinski was quite a crude operator. He would use the bludgeon. I think Kissinger was more skilled, but I mean, I think there was probably less integrity to how he acted in public life than Brzezinski had, at the latter's cost to some degree, particularly with reputation. He would be rude to journalists, Brzezinski, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I'm a journalist. I appreciate people who are polite to you.
One other element about the two of them is that although both of them bemoan the fact that domestic politics is constantly intruding on their conduct of foreign policy, they're both really sort of domestic political animals themselves and get very involved. I mean, at one point you have Ham Jordan, who was Carter's de facto chief of staff, ultimately becomes his chief of staff, and certainly a political operative, suggesting to Brzezinski at one point, we should switch jobs because you're doing all this politics and I'm doing all this national security stuff. But so both of them are very, very political animals. I mean, deeply involved in American national politics. I mean, Kissinger first through his patronage of Nelson Rockefeller, and then picked up by Nixon. Brzezinski through a variety of different, you know, mechanisms, including kind of picking up Carter as a, you know, potential national political figure when Brzezinski is running the Trilateral Commission, which turns out to be a huge payoff for him, you know, by making that bet.
They were inherent political animals. I mean, I think it's right to say that Madeleine Albright, you know, who was a protege of Brzezinski, made the quip to me and to many others that Brzezinski knew a lot more about Soviet politics and what was happening in Moscow than he did about what was happening in Washington. But that should not be mistaken for thinking he didn't try to meddle in Washington. I think he thought, and this is an example she also gave, that senators should come and visit him in his office near the Oval Office rather than him going up to the Hill. And she had to keep reminding him, look, they're elected, you're not. And so Kissinger was a little bit more knowledgeable about that kind of thing. But both of them were sort of inveterate schemers and meddlers into domestic politics. And I love that Hamilton Jordan anecdote, because Jordan says to Brzezinski, look, we should swap places, you know, because he's trying to broker a release of the hostages. He's doing foreign policy. And Brzezinski keeps intervening with advice on how Carter should run his re-election campaign. And when Jordan makes that quip, Brzezinski says, I don't know, can I deploy nuclear weapons in a primary?
That's a good segue to what I wanted to go to next, actually, which is, you know, I think we tend to, in the normal course of things, looking back historically, exaggerate a lot of the differences between administrations because of, you know, political partisanship. But in fact, there's, you know, if you look back from 1945 to up until at least 2017. After that, it gets a little bit more complicated. There's actually much more continuity in U.S. national security policy than one would anticipate from listening to the rhetoric of our quadrennial, you know, political campaigns. And I think, you know, part of the argument we were, or not argument, the discussion we were having earlier about Brzezinski's importance is when you look at the kind of repositioning of U.S. nuclear strategy in the Carter administration, the Presidential Directive 59, the decisions to go ahead with the B-2 bomber and with the MX missile, the cruise missile, the deployment of the SS-20 missiles into Europe. What you see is, despite all the rhetoric and the angst of the 1980 election, you see a lot of stuff that prefigures what Reagan does in his tenure that helped bring about the end of the Soviet Union. And much of that is, if not all of it, is Big Brzezinski's work.
Yeah, and by the way, not just on foreign policy, and I mean, this isn't the subject of the discussion, but in terms of Carter's deregulation, his appointment of Paul Volcker as the inflation slayer, you know, a lot of that prefigured quite a lot of Reaganomics. But the foreign policy continuity is striking, and where I would mark the rupture is not between Carter and Reagan, it's between the first half of Carter's administration, single term, and the second half, because in the first half, basically, Cy Vance got his way, and that was to try to sustain detente and increasingly poor terms of trade, as it were, with the Soviet Union, that Carter had inherited, a sort of declining detente from Ford Kissinger, as he called it, during the campaign. And it was only really in late 78 that Brzezinski really began, mid to late 78, he really began to get his way and win the argument. First of all, with China normalization, which Cy Vance was loath, fought tooth and nail, because Vance wanted SALT II, which he was negotiating, to be the absolute sort of overwhelming, overriding priority. And Brzezinski saw it as a nice to have, but not essential. And once Vance lost that, Brzezinski's skills, but also Carter's frustration with Vance and Leonid Brezhnev's really counterproductive actions on the world stage, essentially won the argument for Brzezinski. And so we get Reaganism, I think, before Reagan. And the only really significant thing that Reagan changes from that second half of the Cold War strategy, second half of Carter administration's Cold War record, was to lift the grain embargo on the Soviet Union, because that was something he had promised in the caucuses to the voters of Iowa, and that was part of the boycott of the Moscow Olympics after the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. So continuity, I think, is very strong there. And just a final quick point to that was Reagan was interested on a few occasions in actually hiring Brzezinski. It never got very far, but I think that really reinforces the premise of your question.
Yeah, I mean, and Zbigniew says in his memoirs that he came into office concerned that the nuclear balance in particular, but the balance of power overall, has shifted, you know, pretty dramatically against the United States. You have a discussion of the Presidential Review Memorandum 10 that he and Sam Huntington kind of set out, which is fascinating because it's a kind of interesting exercise. On the one hand, they want a comprehensive net assessment of the strategic nuclear balance. And then Brzezinski also tasks, and I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, so I apologize, but he tasks the Department of Defense to provide a series of alternative strategies for different regions of the world at different force levels. It's an incredibly complex tasking, which the Department of Defense trips all over itself trying to respond to. It can't really respond to it. In fact, it gives up responding to it. And What's left, though, is the comprehensive net assessment, which basically says that the United States really has the advantage over the Soviet Union in almost everything that matters, except weaponry, and particularly nuclear weaponry, about which there's, you know, some pretty serious concern at that point. And Brzezinski takes it, one of the reasons that you know were adverting to earlier, that he thinks SALT II is nice to have, but not really that important, is because it really only on the margin is going to affect the strategic balance. And what, in his view, really matters is the U.S. redressing that balance. And at the beginning of the administration, I mean, tell me if you disagree with this, but my sense is at the beginning of the administration, the reason Cy Vance is getting his way is that Harold Brown more or less agrees with Vance in the first 2 years of the Carter administration, but comes to become an ally with Brzezinski in the last 2 years. A bit, you know, it's the old neocon story. He's a liberal mugged by reality. I mean, he sees Soviet behavior in the Third World. He sees consistent Soviet cheating, and he sees, in fact, he makes the comment, famous comment, in testimony in late in the Carter administration, when, you know, even though we've shown restraint in building up our nuclear forces over the last decade, we don't see any restraint from the Soviet side. When we build, they build. When we stop building, they continue to build.
Absolutely right. And not only that, pretty sort of credible allegations that they've been cheating on what they'd agreed to in SALT I, negotiated by Nixon-Kissinger.
Yeah, and the ABM treaty. And the ABM treaty.
Because
of the Krasnoyarsk radar.
Absolutely. So you could say, I mean, I don't use that phrase, but you could say that in that respect, Jimmy Carter was a liberal, a McGovern liberal mugged by reality, not just Harold Brown, who, of course, was a California professor, but he really knew his stuff. He'd, you know, been running Caltech. The Carter administration inherited a defense budget that in real terms was 40% lower than in 1968, which is an extraordinary drop. You could argue that was a peace dividend of detente, but you could also argue with increasing plausibility, as Brzezinski did, that this was being exploited by the Soviet Union to step up its adventurism in other parts of the world, in the Horn of Africa, increasingly in Afghanistan, Persian Gulf, and so on. And of course, in Central America via Cuba. And the more this became apparent, the more Vance began to really lose the argument. And I think Carter did change his mind. And, you know, his heart and his head were always in some degree of conflict. In his heart was, we need a world free of nuclear weapons. He had campaigned on a nuclear-free world. But his head increasingly told him to listen to Brzezinski, because Brzezinski's predictive value, and I use the word prophet in the subtitle to this book, because he did have a remarkably good predictive record. His predictive value was borne out, and states tended to be belied by reality. And so, yeah, that is a huge shift in sort of strategic posture, to reverse this creeping Soviet advantage that had been building up over the previous 10, 15 years. And it did reverse it. And Reagan, of course, continued that. And that helped bankrupt the Soviets.
Yeah.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
What ultimately brings Carter down, of course, is the collapse of the Shah's regime in Iran, and then ultimately the seizure of American diplomats as hostages for the last year plus of the Carter administration, only having them released hours after Reagan is sworn in as president in 1981. This is a fascinating story, which I think you tell very even-handedly, because there's a lot of emotion still around that subject, still very fresh in those of us who were alive at the time and remember the America held hostage, and ABC News running a news show every night. You do a nice job of talking about Walter Cronkite and Ted Koppel and the role they played back in the day when our media environment was much less fragmented than it is today, and therefore Americans had much more of a common frame of reference to judge kind of events of the day. You make the point that the State Department's view of this, which was that the Shah was a spent force, that the United States needed to make an accommodation with the opposition forces, including Khomeini, and that it was possible to put together some kind of a coalition government that would be, you know, maybe nationalist in orientation, maybe a little bit more Islamist than the Shah's regime, but would be still fundamentally compatible with U.S. national interests, and presumably with the role that Iran had been assigned by the Nixon administration, but continued under Carter, of being a regional police force for the region, heavily armed by U.S. Defense transfers. I mean, I think Iran in the period after 1973 is the largest consumer of U.S. defense goods and services. State Department view turns out to be a fantasy. Brzezinski is constantly pushing for the Shah to crack down, to reassert his authority. And if the Shah can't do it, he wants some general officer in the Iranian armed forces to do it. You write that was pretty much a fantasy as well, but it does raise, I think, the question of what do policymakers do when presented with, you know, pretty terrible alternatives, pretty terrible choices, and not much, to count on, to be able to bank on in making a policy decision.
I mean, let's go through the counterfactual. If Carter had taken Brzezinski's advice, or if the Shah had been capable of acting on Brzezinski's urgings and cracked down and essentially launched a coup, an auto coup, suppressed the protesters and succeeded, and Iran stabilized the bloody streets for a while, we would not have known what they had presented. So prevented. And so, you know, it's by no means clear that even if Brzezinski was right, history would have thanked him for it. So, you know, that's a very difficult one, but it's clear that, you know, William Sullivan, who was the U.S. ambassador, foreign service officer, ambassador in Tehran, he thought Ayatollah Khomeini was a Gandhi-like figure. So the sort of cupidity, and Henry Precht, who was back here in Washington at Foggy Bottoms, the Iran desk officer, the cupidity, gullibility, arguably, of the state's view on this, Foggy Bottom's view on this, I think is probably less intellectually defensible than Brzezinski's bloody mindedness. He was prepared to just break eggs in order to make an omelet. In this case, keep the Shah in power. All of them were blind, though. You know, the CIA did not have any serious reporting or assets inside Iran. All of its focus was on these listening posts on the Iranian-Soviet border. And the Shah was their client in the region, their strongman, I guess. And they just trusted him to provide any intelligence to them that might be relevant. And of course, that's a conflict of interest. The Shah was clueless about what was coming. And the Carter administration was clueless about the fact that he had terminal cancer, lymphoma.
Yeah, and that he was probably incapable of executing the policy. I wonder whether you, because I've read it before, but you described a pretty extraordinary telegram that William Sullivan sends back to Washington, which I have to say, as a 30-year Foreign Service officer myself, I mean, call me crazy, but strikes me as a reckless act of incredible insubordination, knowing what the President of the United States has ordained as policy. And it strikes me that if you believe what Ambassador Sullivan believed, then you probably should resign and, you know, and then go public with what, it, you know, with your reclama. But did you find it as extraordinary as I did that he would engage in this sort of act of inspiration and doesn't get fired for it, by the way?
And doesn't get fired. You know, he'd had a few months before that, he'd come in the summer of 78 for a long vacation. Via Washington, took 3 months vacation from Tehran, and he wrote a memo before he went on vacation saying that all was fine, it was a stable situation and nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. And then a few months later, he's accusing Carter directly of being reckless for ignoring his advice to hold talks with Ayatollah Khomeini in Paris. And he sends a cable to that effect. And Carter wants to fire him. Brzezinski urges Carter to fire him. Cy Vance pulls Sullivan's bacon out of the fire. And so we get this dual Carter policy, because Carter sends in General Heisser, who was deputy, as you know, to Haig, to Alexander Haig, as the sort of Pentagon's guy. So you have a State Department strategy, which is, let's all, you know, get along and hold hands with the mullahs. And you've got a Defense Department, Brzezinski-backed, separate line of a negotiation to try and put spine into the generals so that they can crack down on this revolution. And therefore, they cancel each other out. Neither wins. Chaos wins.
Yeah. And we're, in some sense, still reckoning with the consequences of all of that today, which does show you that history really is relevant here when it comes to sort of unraveling some of these knotty problems. We're running a little bit short on time, and I don't want to abuse your time. I know you have other things to get on to.
But no, it's a delight. The abuse is very much the wrong word.
So the Carter administration, I mean, Carter loses the election in November of 1980, in part because there are so many times when the American public thinks the hostage deal is going to get done and the hostages will come home. It doesn't happen. The undecided voters break very strongly for Reagan. Reagan also, by the way, in my view, demolishes Carter in the debate. I remember watching the debate actually from Israel, where I was serving at the time. Watching it live, I thought that Reagan actually really pretty much made mincemeat politically out of Carter. Reagan wins, but Carter's not done yet, because there's a major crisis that breaks in the last month and a half of the Carter administration, which I think people don't, it's kind of been lost a little bit in the mists of time because so much else happened later on in the Reagan years. But there's a major crisis over solidarity in Poland and the potential that the Soviets will actually invade Poland, much as they did Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968. And in some ways, I mean, when I read your book, I thought, you know, actually this is, and I hadn't thought about it this way before. This is really Brzezinski's sort of finest hour in a sense, because this is a subject, of course, about which he knows a great deal, because it's Poland. Because he has this incredible epistolary relationship with Pope John Paul II, with whom he's in touch, and who has, because he's, you know, Polish by origin himself, the Pope has enormous sway in Poland. And he also has, as you point out, a unique kind of intelligence find, which is the reporting of Colonel Kuklinski, a Polish military officer who is doing the liaison work with the essentially with the Soviet military. And so the Americans are actually remarkably well informed about Soviet planning for all this. And Brzezinski also, not just because he's Polish, but because, as you point out, he is sort of founded the sub-discipline in Sovietology of comparative communism, and knows intimately the history of 1956 and 1968, wants to make sure that it's not repeated, and succeeds. And I'm just curious how the whole episode struck you.
Again, this is, you know, actually a better example of history not thanking you for what didn't happen.
Right.
Because the non-invasion of Poland, you know, I mean, it's a huge sort of crisis averted. It would have been a more dramatic scale, and I think more difficult for the Soviets than either Hungary or Czechoslovakia. Poland presented a much sort of deeper ideological conundrum, even confusion, to the Soviets, because Solidarity wasn't just the working class. It wasn't just a trade union that was anti-socialist, anti-communist at least. But their icon was the Pope. This just is not in the Marxian sort of frame of reference to have a religious working class rebelling against communism. And the Pope understood very well that ethic. Brzezinski did too. And they managed, I think, in tandem, also by coaxing Lech Walesa, the Solidarity leader, not to be too provocative when the Soviets built up their divisions on Poland's border. When the invasion looked imminent, you know, there were 18 divisions on the border, 15 Soviet, 2 East German, in spite of German-Polish history, and 1 Czech division. They were about to invade. And the Pope and Brzezinski, sort of between them, with the help of others, convinced the Soviets that Poland would be indigestible, that it was a porcupine. And Colonel Kuklinski, he was known as Jack Strong by the CIA. His intelligence was top level, raw intelligence that Brzezinski did not want any interpretation put on. It was handed to him raw in the Polish, and he made good use of it. And I agree with, I think this was his finest hour, and he'll never fully get thanked for it, because we can't prove that the Soviets would otherwise have invaded.
It's true, but you know, it's sort of striking. I mean, you're right. I mean, there was an old joke that, you know, given Poland's history, the Poles used to tell about if we were invaded simultaneously from the East and the West, you know, who would you fight first? Oh, well, we would fight the Germans first. I mean, it was business before pleasure. but you know, the idea that the Russians could have gone in, it would have been very messy. I think there would have been resistance. There might have even been fragmentation of the Polish military. So it was very daunting. But the fact that the U.S. conveyed very directly, both publicly and privately, that the consequences of this would be far worse than what had happened a year earlier in Afghanistan, when the Soviets went into Afghanistan, which was already pretty considerable. And the fact that they started talking about what they might sell the Chinese, which was a matter of great concern to the Russians. It's hard to imagine that this did not weigh pretty heavily in Moscow's calculus.
I think that's got to be right. I mean, I should say that the If there's another controversy that dogs Brzezinski's reputation, it is the US response to the invasion of Afghanistan, which he saw, I think rightly, as many people did, as the Soviets' quagmire, their own Vietnam. And of course, he persuaded Carter 6 months before the Soviets invaded to pass a covert action, fairly small potatoes, $695,000, non-kinetic. It didn't involve guns, and it involved propaganda mostly in the refugee camps, in the rural areas rather of Afghanistan, and broadcasts in and Dari and Pashto, and various other propaganda tools. But the idea that Brzezinski gave birth to Al Qaeda surfaced after 9/11, and for sure, he did really encourage, and after the invasion, get Carter to fund the, to arm the Mujahideen, including some pretty radical Islamist groups, on the principle, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And he saw that as being a price worth paying. And he did sound, you know, as Carter didn't have any trouble doing, but Brzezinski, it sounded pretty false. He did make lots of appeals to God when he addressed some of the Afghan refugees, and they were all on the same side fighting for God against it. So some of it looks pretty bad in retrospect, but I think it's unfair to sort of pin Al-Qaeda on him, because that's, you know, that doesn't come into being until a few years later.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I mean, that is a very vexed question, but I mean, I think Brzezinski probably, because of his flair for the dramatic and his desire to be in the news, which you document. I mean, you have a wonderful story about him and my former boss, Bob Gates, that you tell about, you know, Brzezinski's desire to be in the press, even when his staff was trying to protect him from himself. But he goes to the Khyber Pass and points a rifle, you know, across into the border, which drives everybody in the State Department crazy. It ends up on the front pages of the Post and the Times. So it's easy to caricature, you know, his role in that. As a, I sit uncomfortably at the junction of, you know, several things. I mean, I was a trained historian before I became a diplomat. I was a diplomat for 30 years, and I bear, you know, some, you know, responsibility for not what he started, but what he continued. I had on the Soviet desk from 1984 to 86, I had the, you know, Afghan portfolio, where I worked with a young Afghan American who was in the policy planning staff, Zal Khalilzad, on all of this, including the Stinger stuff. So, you know, my view is that the defeat of the Soviet Union and I then went on to Embassy Moscow from 87 to 89, where I also had the Afghanistan brief during the Geneva negotiations that led to the Soviet withdrawal. My view is that the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan and the withdrawal was the beginning of the end for the Soviet Union. It was the beginning of the end because it completely knocked the ideological props out from under the regime. Because the idea, the Brezhnev doctrine that, you know, the conquests of socialism were irreversible and that it was the historical wave of the future, was suddenly exposed to be what, you know, what Gorbachev called a sucking, bleeding wound. To me, that was the beginning of the end. And it's one of the reasons why I think Brzezinski does deserve enormous credit, you know, for not just that, but the other things we've discussed this past hour. I would love to keep you longer. Ed, thank you so much, though, for joining us today on Shield of the Republic. I want to remind our listeners and viewers that the book is big, The Life of Zbigniew Brzezinski, America's Great Power Prophet. It's out this week, and I encourage everybody to read it. And I hope we can get you back from time to time on Shield of the Republic, not necessarily talk about books, but a lot of other things going on in the world, including a lot of great power stuff that Zbigniew Brzezinski foresaw. So,
Eric, that was a true pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. We'll be right back.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.